like that in Ireland. You won't find it. Somebody opens the meeting for you, they give out a hymn, they make the announcements, they pray, they give out another hymn, and that's it. Nobody's standing up there. They feel that people can sing congregationally without a band leader. So I gave out the hymn, and I prayed, and I gave out another hymn, and then he took the meeting. A couple of weeks later, he took me out with him, and he said, "Now, give out a hymn this time, pray, give out another hymn, and tell how you were saved in 5 minutes. No more. And then sit down and leave the rest up to me." So I did. And he took me to little country meetings like this. And that's how I started.
Amen.
Somebody else would take me out, and then I was invited back to some of these places. I had a chum, he and I, by this time, by the way, I had got a job serving my apprenticeship in this business. And I had this chum in the meeting where we were, in the assembly where we were, and he came over to our house every Saturday, and we spent the whole of Saturday studying the Bible together. I had a little attic upstairs. My father bought me a little gas fire so that in the cold or damp weather we could light this. We sat at a table. He had lunch with us, his dinner or supper, whatever you want to call it, with us. Now, then we got said, why don't we occasionally, when it's a nice Saturday afternoon, get on our bicycles and go to such and such a corner and have an open-air meeting, which we did. So gradually like this, I got more and more into work. Then I discovered that if I went down to my work on the streetcar and came back at lunchtime, because we got an hour off for lunch in the wholesale business, on the way down in the streetcar and back for lunch and back down to work and back in the evening again, it only cost 2 pennies in those days to travel in the streetcar, I could read the whole of Romans on those 4 trips. And so I read the Romans for nearly a month, on once a day, just in the streetcar. And I learned to use odd time like this. Then I decided that I was wasting a lot of time coming up and down on the streetcar. And so I stayed in. My mother gave me a little pint bottle of milk and made me a bread and butter sandwich or whatever. And I ate that in 15 minutes, and I had 3/4 of an hour. I fell in with a fellow who got me some secondhand books, and I started devouring books in the Bible and reading. And I was getting invitations to go out here and there and here and there and preach. And by the time I was 17, I was preaching practically every weekend. And then we had a thing called village work over there in those days. See, the north of Ireland is totally different from anything you can envisage here in America. It's a very small country, 70 by 70. There are only 2 cities in it, that is cities, Belfast and Londonderry or Derry. Belfast has only about 200,000 of a population, and there are 16 assemblies in it. The whole of the north of Ireland has only a population of 1.25 million, and there are 160, is that 26 assemblies, sorry, in Belfast, and 160 assemblies in the rest of Ulster, that little country 70 by 70. Only 2 cities. Now, there are fairly sized towns too, but all over the country are these little villages, farming villages, market villages, just little villages of people. And since the troubles that have affected Belfast more and more, people have tended to move out of the city and live in these little villages. So if you take a picture from any kind of a height, you might have 20 or 30 villages in front of you. And we started what we called the village work. There were a group of about 15 of us every Saturday in the summertime. We got on our bicycles. We contributed money to buy tracts with. And every Saturday, we'd go out. We had a thermos of tea, didn't grin for coffee in those days. They were about as bad at making coffee as Americans are at making tea. So we had a thermos of tea and a sandwich on the back of the bike and a raincoat, and about 15 or so of us would pedal off to villages. And we'd have open air meetings in maybe 5 or 6 little villages through the country, give out tracts to every house in it, and then preach the gospel at all the crossroads and all the cross streets and that kind of thing. And these are the ways in which we, as young men in those days, spread our wings. So I was busy in the gospel through the week as well, attended the meetings in the assembly, of course. Bible readings and prayer meetings were separate nights. It wasn't that we never dreamed of putting two together. You had a prayer meeting on Tuesday night and a Bible reading on Thursday night, or vice versa. The north of Ireland was that it was visited by the great 59 revival. That was in the Presbyterian Church, by the way. And that is where the assemblies in Ulster came from. It's a very odd thing that the Brethren movement, which started in Dublin, had no influence whatsoever in the north of Ireland. None. And it was almost entirely, to begin with, among the wealthier people in the south, the Anglo-Irish landlords in the big estates, you see, because Derby and Bellet and these men were all men of the upper class. And the work, a lot of the work started in Dublin University, or it's not called Dublin University, it's called Trinity College Dublin. So it tended to be among the landlords. They had Bible studies in their homes. If you look at chief men among the Brethren, scores of them were Irish, these leading men. And somebody once asked Taylor, exclusively, is that is the father, not Big Jim, that brought disaster to them. But the father, James Taylor, trying to get up a sleeve in a Bible reading in New York, once said to him, Brother Taylor, why is it, he was Irish, of course, James Taylor, why is it that so many of the leading men and the great men of the Brethren movement were Irish? They were trying to get up a sleeve, you know. And he thought for a minute and he said, I really don't know. Except it could be that where sin did abound, grace did much more abound. Anyway, the 59 revival started roaring across the country spontaneously in the Presbyterian churches. Started near Ballymena in a cottage. Thousands of people got saved. Ministers got saved. My father remembered their minister up in County Donegal, where he was brought up. That's in the Republic, by the way. So I'm half and half. My mother was from County Antrim, my father from County Donegal. And by the way, the name Long in Ireland was originally De Long, and they were Huguenots who were expelled and persecuted from France, came over to England, and of course they didn't want more Protestants in England, so they shoved them over into Ireland, and that's where they came from. But many of the Presbyterian ministers got saved. My father remembered the minister in their church getting into the pulpit one Sunday morning and saying, my beloved congregation, I have been preaching in this church for 25 years and I wasn't a Christian. Now I have become a Christian by new birth, and it split the church right down the middle. And of course he was pushed out. Many of these men became totally dissatisfied with this because they found believers' baptism, they found the breaking of bread, they found separation from the world, no unbelievers in congregation. They got up and they hammered on this in the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church, and gradually they were forced out. That's how the North of Ireland assemblies really started, not through the Dublin movement at all, despite the fact that C.H. McIntosh lived in Belfast. And he tried to gather some of these men around him, but of course he was very exclusive, he was of the exclusive party, and they wouldn't go along with this. So there is this fervor in the gospel. My mother was saved as a teenager when two Presbyterian clergymen were going all over that part of the country with a tent preaching the gospel. They had no church. Two young clergymen, still with their dog collars on, preaching in all the towns through County Antrim, and my mother got saved. That was the tail end of the 59 revival. So there has always been a real, I don't know what it is, a thrust, a fervor, a determination. Of course, this is why they're so stubborn in some ways, you know. No surrender. We don't give in easily. So I find myself engaged in this kind of work, and as I say, by the time I was 17, I was invited all over these little assemblies in the north of Ireland preaching the gospel. But during the time that I must back up a little. My father got saved. He wasn't a believer. When my mother married him, she thought he was, because he was an officer in the church. And she married him believing that he was a believer. But of course, she didn't have a lot of teaching in the Presbyterian church either. He turned out he wasn't saved at all. Got tangled up in the Masonic order, as I already mentioned. At that, there's a good deal of feasting and festivities. They call them banquets, and quite a bit of drinking and this type of thing. He was never a pub crawler. He wasn't a man who got drunk all the time. He carried on his work, but he got into drink. He was a frightful smoker. His fingers were burnt brown up to here. His grandmother died in Donegal. This is the hand of God. His grandmother died in Donegal, and he was the eldest of seven children. They'd been brought up with the grandmother. The mother died at the birth of the eighth child, which also died. And her mother, that is my father's grandmother, came home, lived with her son-in-law, and raised the whole family. And she was the only granny I ever knew, but she was really my great-granny. She died, and my father fell heir to this little farm in Donegal, which he didn't want, because at that time the Republic had come in, the partition of Ireland, and he got this little amount of money and bought this dairy business. This is how we moved to a totally new part of the country. And the nearest Presbyterian church was too far for us to go to. My father was now in the wholesale dairy business, 7 days a week, no Sundays off, because of warm milk pasteurization. And so we were not going to church anywhere. My sister, 6 years younger than I, and I were sitting in the summertime playing in the front lawn. I would have been about ten. My mother was sitting on the front windowsill knitting, and an elderly man got off his bicycle, came over and bid her good afternoon. Nor Ulster people, everybody speaks to everybody except in the big cities. He said, "Good afternoon, ma'am. You're new here, yes. Well, welcome to our part of the country. Do you go to church?" And we chatted for a minute or two, and he said, "Do you go to church anywhere?" And she said, "No, we don't. We're Presbyterians, and the nearest church is carried off, and it's too far to go. My husband's in the dairy business." He said, "So the children don't go to Sunday school?" "No." But he said, "That's very sad. We have a little hall up on the hill up there, about 2 miles away. Not very big, not very grand, but we have a Sunday school, and if you would send the children there, one thing, they will never hear anything but the gospel." So my mother asked my father. He had quit going to church, threw the whole thing overboard before this. And they said, "Yeah, you want to send them, it's up to you." So we went. We prize giving came in about 3 months, and we didn't deserve a prize, but we got a prize. One of us got a text and the other got a New Testament. My father looked at me and said, "Well, they're not mean anyway." Then we brought home invitations to special gospel meetings that were being held. And my mother showed this bill to my father and said, "Would you go with me?" He said, "Nope." He said, "Well, would it be all right if I went?" He said, "No, it's up to you. No problem." So she went, and my mother, for the first time in all those years of hardship and sorrow and poverty, was set on fire by hearing the word of God again. So, of course, she started praying for my father, and he was in trouble. she kept after him, "Wouldn't you come to hear these men?" He said, "What do you mean, these men? Is there more than one?" She said, "Yes, there are two." She said, "I never heard of two clergymen in one church." She said, "It isn't a church, and there aren't clergymen." "Well, if they're not clergymen, then why are they preaching?" "Well," she said, "they're preaching the gospel. One is an evangelist, a full-time worker. He's an old man with a snow-white beard. And the other is a younger man, and he is in a big jewelry shop, big jewelry store, down in High Street in the middle of Belfast. He's in a high-class jewelry store, and he preaches in the evening." She said, "I never heard of that kind of thing." So she kept after him until he went. And here's this mystery of God. Years before, when my father had driven a milk van for another man, he used to go to a shop and deliver milk to two maiden ladies who in turn sold some to the neighbors. They had a nephew, a little 10-year-old guy. He liked to drive my father's horse. It wasn't my father's, but the one my father drove, from there round a street or two. It was a great joy to him. But he was only allowed to do this when he had run the errands for the store. You know, people wanted a pint of milk, he took it. People wanted half a pound of tea, he took it, this kind of thing. And when his aunts wouldn't let him drive the horse for a street or two, he'd kick the counter and kick the door and lie down on the floor and kick the counter with both feet, and he had a terrible stutter, but he couldn't get a word out. My father walks into this meeting 20 or whatever years later, and who's preaching but this boy? And of course, he didn't recognize my father, but my father recognized him. And he had his pipe with him. My father's a frightful smoker. He knew he couldn't smoke cigarettes. So he loaded his pipe, put it in his pocket with a box of matches, and he was in torment during this meeting. So he came out. All this has a bearing on my work, by the way. I'm not just meandering. He came out with his... He was furious because he said this preacher knew him and never had given over. He just preached right at him the whole time. Of course, this was his conscience because the man didn't know him at all. My father got out, dying for a smoke, put this beautiful pipe that he was very fond of, with a pure amber mouthpiece and a silver band around it and a buckhorn head or something, and he went to light it. Somebody jostled his elbow and the pipe went over the hedge. And the image matters still. He would never put his feet back in it again, but a week later my mother got him to go. It was every night in the week. And of course in Ireland they carry on gospel campaigns for 5, 6, 7, 8, 10, 12 weeks in a row until people start getting saved. One preacher I knew, and he just died a year or two ago, he had meetings continuously for 26 weeks in one of the Belfast assemblies. And when he was giving a report of this at the Easter conference, he said, "People asked me why it took 26 weeks at Matchett Street." He said, "It took the first 10 weeks to get the Christians into any kind of condition where God could save anybody." So my father went, and conviction set in. And finally he got saved. But of course the home was transformed. He took down his big certificate of the Royal Arch Preceptory of the Black Order of the Masonic Order, gave it away. He had a big sash with silver emblems on it. Out it went. Out went the cigarettes. He didn't have to go to a doctor or to a psychiatrist or anything else to break the habit. He suffered, mind you, but he just took it and threw it away, and that was that. He and my mother were baptized, and the house was just transformed. The very first prize I got after that one was called Among the Wigwams and Kraals. This was the Spirit of God, too. Among the wigwams was David Brainerd, who preached the gospel up and down New England on a horse, a riding horse, and slept in English teepees all over the place and died a young man, totally ruined in health. And, of course, among the Kraals was David Livingstone of Africa. And I became completely entranced with carrying the gospel to people who had never heard it. And I wasn't yet saved. I was only about 10 or 11. My mother took a hand in it. And from there on, any birthday present I got, and I didn't get many, as I said, we were never accustomed to toys or gigos of any kind. We just didn't have the money for it. But she would buy me a book, and it was always a missionary book. And there was the hand of God again. I read about the oppression of the black people here in America and everything. Of course, America to me was the other side of the moon. Country boy. Until I went to Africa, I had never been outside the six counties of Ulster in my life. That's how green I was. My mother kept me supplied with missionary books. And I remember saying to her one day, well, the Tuskegee Institute down in the South, which was established to educate the newly liberated black people, they had a big choir, the Tuskegee Choir, and they came over to the UK and had big concerts to raise money for Tuskegee Institute. And they broke up into smaller groups and came to the schools. And a bunch of them came to the school I was at. By the way, I walked 2.5 miles to school and 2.5 miles back until my father bought me a second-hand ladies' bike, which was advertised in the paper for 30 shillings. That would be about 75 cents now. They came and they sang some of these plantation songs, and I got mad. Darling Nellie Gray, they have taken you away. They have taken you to Georgia, to the cotton and the cane, and I'll never see my Nellie anymore. And I got a thing about this. We moved into town, as I said, to get my father. This was another jump ahead. To get my father this treatment. And in that assembly, that was the assembly that we went to in the city that Ernest Wilson had been commended from to go to Africa. He was still in Africa on his first term. And they read letters from him, and I became very interested in this man. He was hero worship in his own assembly. And he came home, and I heard him tell of the need in Africa. Where he was, he was 8 days on foot from the nearest town, the nearest doctor, the nearest railroad, the nearest radio station. Of course, he didn't have a radio. They weren't that plentiful in those days, and he didn't have the money for it anyway. Total isolation. There was a mud road, a dirt track, like a logging track, to the place where he had settled with his wife. There was another girl from Ireland working with them who later had to come home because of sickness. And he told of the need for somebody to help them in this work. His wife had nearly died. She'd been carried in a hammock several hundred miles out to the railhead and got her out to the coast and home to save her life. And the Spirit of God really spoke to me. At that time, I would have been about 17 and a half, less than 18. But day and night, I followed him around wherever he had meetings. My parents invited him to our house. And this whole idea of these people who had never heard the gospel, the area where he was in was totally untouched. There were no other missionaries. And then he went away, went back. Of course, I was much too young to talk to him about it or anything like that. But I was haunted. I was burdened about this work. I was preaching more and more all the time, of course, and getting very comfortable about this, intending probably to end up as a preacher in the north of Ireland, that kind of thing. But this wouldn't die in my mind. He had received a gift through a man. And he lived in Kansas City, but I can't remember his name for the moment. He had a little magazine. And in this magazine, he published letters from missionaries. And anybody who wants to send a gift to a missionary, his name will come to me in a minute. He's a great friend of the Pals of Grand Rapids. And I later got to know him. As a matter of fact, I ministered with him in various places at conferences. He had this little magazine. He had passed on a gift from somebody else to Ernest Wilson. Ernest was on his way to Africa and wrote a letter back to him thanking him for the gift. And in that letter he said, well, I have to back up a second here. I had never seen this magazine. It was published in the United States and I was in Ireland. Never saw it in my life. I have no idea how a copy of this little magazine with letters from missionaries got into my hands at all. Somehow it did. And Ernest Wilson had written a letter on the boat going back to Africa to this man, and it was published in the little magazine that turned up. I never saw the magazine again, and I have no idea how I got it, but in it was a little extract from the letter. We are on our way back to Angola with very sad hearts. One young lady is going with us to help my wife in the little clinic work that we have and in teaching children and so on. But during our more than a year in the United States and the United Kingdom, not one young man has suggested joining us in this work, and we are disappointed. And it just hit me like an express train right in the face. So I started now praying about it.
17 and a half years old still, right?
Yep. Mind you, people said, this is not a compliment, so I can repeat it. People always said I was a very old-fashioned, you know, we use that word, he's an old-fashioned type of kid, very old-fashioned. They told me that I had an old man's head on a youngster's body, and teased me with this kind of thing, because I suppose I was a bit old-fashioned or for my age or something. But at 18 and a half or so, I was very concerned about this. I knew, of course, that I couldn't go then, but we moved to another assembly because my father got well enough again, got some money, scrabbled together, and bought another dairy business over in the other end of the city. And one morning, coming out of the meeting, knowing how much I was preaching around and how much I was working at this kind of thing, one of the elders put his arm around my shoulder, and he said, David, have you ever thought of serving the Lord as a missionary? I said, yes, I have, a lot. He said, I believe that you'll be there. So I didn't have to go to them to tell them about my interest. They came to me, or he came to me, quite unofficially. Well, I worked away about this, and then finally, because I have to telescope this a bit now, I did go to the elders, and they said, well, you know, we know all about you and how you're engaged and all that kind of thing, but, you know, you're so young that if we commended you and anything went wrong, the other assemblies round about, we'd never be forgiven for it. And I said, what do I do about it? So they had meetings and meetings and meetings and meetings. And then finally they came up with a sort of a coward's solution. They said, you have told us about your exercise. By this time, of course, I would have been, I suppose, close to 20. They said, you've told us about your exercise, and we are quite clear, but nobody has ever been commanded to go to Africa as young as you are. So how would you feel if we invited all the elders of all the 26 meetings in Belfast here to the hall, and you would tell them what you've told us? And then if they all were happy about it, this is what you call in America passing the buck, I think. Nobody ever had to do this before. Nobody ever has done it since, I'm quite certain. And Leonard Sheldrake was the name of the man with the little magazine. Leonard Sheldrake. As a matter of fact, he had a daughter who until fairly recently worked with the Pells at the press in Grand Rapids, Ruth Sheldrake. So they did this. And here I am, by this time I suppose nearly 19, about 19. Oh, I had written to Ernest Wilson. It took me a long time to pump up the courage. Finally I wrote a letter, this was a way back, asking him if there would even be a possibility that I could fill any kind of a position in helping spread the gospel out there. And I carried this letter around in my pocket for 2 weeks before I had the courage to post it. It was all crumpled up by this time. And then I took it to the mailbox, and I stuck it in and I pulled it back and I kept it for another few days. And then one day I pushed it over, and it hadn't hit the bottom till I was wondering if there was any way of getting a letter back from the post office or the mailman who came to empty the box. He wrote back and said, "I can't tell you whether you're called to Africa or not. But I can tell you one thing. Do not come unless you are absolutely sure that you are called by God, because you'll never make it otherwise. There's no glamour. There's no halo around a missionary's head. It is a hard, disappointing, physically draining, mentally exhausting work. If God calls you, you're welcome here, because we were not blind to your exercise while we were at home. And if God leads you, there's a welcome awaiting you." So that was that. Then, of course, these men all got together, and several of the big-time preachers in Ireland were there. And I had to tell this whole story again, and they seemed to feel satisfied about it. So my elder said, "Well, go ahead now and try to prepare yourself a bit." So I got a set of Portuguese self-taught, which wasn't much good to me. But anyway, I worked at it, because we had to go to Portugal, you see, for 6 months, or for as long as it took us to learn Portuguese, because we could only get a visa from the Portuguese government to go out after we learned Portuguese, so we could communicate with the authorities and pass an exam in it. So I had to go there first. But I worked a little bit on my own, bought a Portuguese Bible and so on, and set off. I thought I was doing a big thing when, the night I faced up to Romans 12 and 1, "I beseech you, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice." I didn't want to go to Africa. I had struck up a friendship with a girl in the assembly previous to this one that I'd been in. It wasn't a very emotional thing. Went for walks on Saturday afternoon, but her mind was absolutely fixed against going to be a missionary. And so the whole thing died. That was the only girl I ever took out or had any kind of relationship with until I married my first wife in Africa. She came from Nova Scotia. I left Ireland when I was 20 years of age. And a few days. I was 20 about the end of May, and I sailed on the 10th of July, 1933. I went to Portugal. I had one footlocker and a hand suitcase. That was my total equipment. Nothing more. I went to Portugal. I studied Portuguese very hard. I worked at it. I would talk about total immersion. I was thrown right into the Portuguese family. When I got there, I took the money that would be my fare, and that was about £20 in those days, to Africa, steerage, among the, you know, the riffraff at their stern end of the boat. And I put that money away, and I said, "Even if I starve, I still have my passage to Africa." And I nearly did starve, too, because I had to pay for lessons. I had 5 lessons a week. I talked Portuguese all day. When I was there about 3 months, I took a Sunday school class in the assembly in a slum mission. When I was there 5 months, I preached for the first time in one of the halls in Lisbon in Portugal. And from there on, I was preaching nearly every Sunday somewhere in Portuguese. Got a boat from out of Lisbon, and I nearly didn't make it. First of all, I had left my cabin trunk in Bonn because I didn't want to pay any customs duty on it. And I thought it would just stay there till I got out 6 months later. And they had it up for auction in a different department when I went for it to put it on the boat, but we managed to get it out. I got on the boat, finally, and that was all my belongings. Got on the boat, and they pulled up the gangplank. Some of the Portuguese Christians came down, a couple of missionaries, and they pulled up the gangplanks. And the boat was ready to sail when I was tapped on the shoulder and taken to the purser's office, and they said, "You can't sail because your passport is minus one stamp from the civil government here at the City Hall." And I said, "You've had my passport all along," told me. "Sorry, you can't." I said, "I have to go. My stuff's on board and there'll be somebody at the coast waiting for me." "Sorry, sir." So a young fellow in uniform, he was a steward, came up and said, "Follow me." There was one gangplank still there. We rushed down, grabbed a taxi. He said, "Drive the fastest you can go to the City Hall." We went there, we got the visa, we came back, and the ship was gone. But he said, "It's all right, it'll stop down at the bar to let off the pilot." So he dragged me onto a little motorboat belonging to the company. Of course, I was all dressed up just like a little North of Ireland preacher, you know, dark overcoat and trilby hat and all the rest of it. Got in this boat, we went down the River Tagus to the bar, and sure enough, the boat had paused, and the pilot was coming down a rope ladder down the side of this liner. He got down, and we pulled our launch ahead, and I got on board climbing up this rope ladder, and of course it was swinging like a pendulum. Everybody in the boat was looking down to see this little English. They called everybody English. They called Englishes beefs because they burned so badly in Portugal with the sun. Here I was with my preacher's hat and my preacher's coat going up the side of the boat, and when I got to the top, they pulled me over the rail and everybody clapped and cheered. And I managed to get to Africa. When I paid £2 or £3 at the coast, Ernest Wilson met me there, by the way, the boat. And we have been intimate friends. I served my missionary apprenticeship with this man of God. It was the making of me. And we've been intimate friends ever since. I talked to him on the phone last night. His days are done. And I suppose I'm the oldest of the men of that generation anymore. When I paid what duty I had to pay, or examination fee, at the customs house, I started up country 800 miles inland with the sum total of £6 as my total monetary background. £6. Now, the pound was worth about $5 at the time. And money was worth more, of course, but call it somewhere around about $30, and a footlocker and a suitcase, and I headed in. 2 days on the train, 2 days on his old 1930 Model A Ford pickup, and we landed in the bush. And that's how it started. And it was that old car that I blew the engine of, and that God pulled a Ford Model A year 30 engine out of the bag, and two mechanics to take all the parts off. It was just a block. Take all the parts off this block, put it on off mine, put it in, refit it and everything else, because we had to be away in a very short time for the birth of my first child. I had been married in the meantime. Would you care to hear the rest of that story when we come back after tea?
Is this a Model A Ford?
Pardon?
Is that the model age group?
That they were getting to, yes. Yes, it's time. 5 o'clock? 5:30 dinner. You have 30 minutes for this. And that, there were no cars, there were no other cars like that there at that time. The Portuguese officer had one, but it was a Chev. That was the only one in the whole, that whole section of the country. The Wilsons had gone on furlough, and he left the car with me. And on the last trip before we would go for my wife's confinement, this way, and this way, about 600 miles over dirt roads, in the wet season, mud up to the axles. I went to get some supplies at the railhead, which was at Melange, and overloaded the thing, and coming back, I blew a cylinder head gasket. Managed to get one of those, got it fitted, but the pump in those old Fords, the oil pump, this is just to whet your appetite, the oil pump sat in a little circle in the oil pan, and you had to fit it up in, but you had to get the spindle that drove that oil pump geared into a little shaft up here. No, I didn't get that properly in place. Put the oil pan on, put it in, cranked it, no self-starter of course, cranked it, it caught, away it went, but the pump fell over and the crankshaft hit it and drove the pump right out through the side of the block. And my wife was due to travel those hundreds of miles. God provided a motor. No assembly could have provided, even if they had guaranteed me total support, which none of them did.
Brother, could we just close the prayer?